Great. So once again, welcome. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everyone. We're very excited to have the HIV Cure webinar series. As you can see, we're going to be talking about ethics, which is the which are some of the difficult questions that I know we've all been struggling with. And we're very excited to have both Lori Silla and Sam Garner. Lori comes to us from the Defeat HIV Tab, which is one of the Martin Delaney collaboratories. It's also quite early for 7 a.m., so we're very excited to have her on. Sam Garner is a contract bioethicist at the Division of AIDS, so really dealing with these presentations and really dealing with this, these issues every day. So we're excited to have both of them, and Sam got his master's in bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, is actually going on to get his Juris Doctorate, his JD, very soon as well. So we're very excited to have both of them on. This is a participatory webinar. So what that means is we would like you to ask questions and to go ahead and interact with our presenters, either through the chat function or by hitting *7 to unmute your line. If you are on the web, we do ask that you go ahead and hit go ahead and type in your answers into the chat function. But once again, this is a participatory webinar. They will be having conversations, and we hope that you will be joining in. So Lori and Sam, are you both unmuted?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you, Lori.
Okay, Sam? I guess I'm unmuted then.
Sam, are you?
Am I there now?
There you are there. Great.
Okay, cool. I hit *7 and it worked, which is really exciting.
Yeah, so you can, as you, Sam can see, you can hit *7 to go ahead and unmute your line. I'm just going to, so I'm going to actually control this. There we go. I'm going to control the slides because it seems like, so I'm just going to control the slides today. So if you both can just hit unmute. Or just go ahead and just tell me next slide. But go ahead
okay.
And start.
So Lori and I are going to tag team this. So Jess already introduced us. Lori, I don't know if there's anything else you want to say, but otherwise I was just going to get into the first section on ethics.
No, right. I'm good.
Okay. So good morning, good afternoon, good evening, I guess. Thanks, everyone, for joining. Jess has already introduced us and this part of the AVAC curriculum series, which is a fantastic pun. So we're going to be offering an overview. We have a lot of information in here. We're going to be offering an overview of the ethical issues in HIV cure research. But as Jess mentioned, the primary goal is really to have discussion, so please chime in. And Jess is going to be moderating. So the overview of the session, very roughly, is we're going to talk a little bit about ethics and research ethics in HIV cure research. We're going to have a very brief overview of the different HIV cure strategies, just to give us some grounding in the science. We're not going to spend too much time on it because that's not our expertise, but also there has been another webinar on this, I understand. Then we're going to go into some selected ethical challenges in HIV cure research, just things that we think are important and that have come up a lot that deserve discussion. And then we're going to run through some potential ethical challenges for some of the specific cure strategies, the different kinds of science that's being done. And then we have set aside time for discussion, but of course people can bring up points throughout. Next slide, please. So the first thing we're going to cover is what is ethics, just to give us some grounding in how to think about this conceptually. So next slide. So generally speaking, we're asking the question, what should be done or what ought to be done? To begin to answer this, we have to identify, analyze, and resolve conflicts of value. In clinical research, there are a number of values that concern us, which we're going to get to in a few slides, but they can conflict. Next slide. Although regulations play an important role in clinical research when we're, you know, thinking about what we can and cannot do, ethics is not the same thing as regulations or laws. Regulatory standards could be met, but a study might still be unethical, and the other way around. Next slide, please. Now, why do we care about research ethics? Next slide. Historically speaking, the Nazi concentration camp experiments, which many people are very familiar with during the Second World War, were so egregious that, next slide, many of those involved were put on trial for crimes against humanity as part of the Nuremberg Military Tribunal. This led to the creation of the Nuremberg Code, which has played an influential role in our research ethics regulations and guidelines. For those of you who are not familiar, or if any of you are not familiar with kind of the historical details surrounding the trial and the creation of the code, I recommend reading about it. It's very fascinating just to see how things evolved. Next slide. So a tremendous amount has happened since Nuremberg. We're not going to cover it here, but the following framework has become an important tool in helping us clarify what values matter so we can begin to navigate the ethics of clinical research in a coherent and structured way. So this comes from a more recent paper by Lowe and Grady in 2013. They're borrowing from a framework that was developed and published back in 2000 in JAMA in an article called What Makes Clinical Research Ethical, I believe. So the very generally, the kinds of things that we should think about when we're thinking about the ethics of clinical research are scientific validity. Are we doing good science? Is it going to answer the research question? Social value. Is the research going to, you know, produce valuable insights and provide important benefits to society? Scalability. Is the end product going to be something that can be implemented to do what we're aiming to do, fair participant selection, are benefits and burdens equitably distributed between research participants and the people who may benefit from the research. Next slide. Is there a favorable risk-benefit ratio? Are the risks minimized appropriately and acceptable in relation to the either direct benefits to participants or the overall social benefits of the research? Informed consent, confidentiality, and privacy. So are we adequately informing participants so that they can make reasonably voluntary decisions consistent with their values? And is their information being protected appropriately? Community engagement. Are communities that are impacted by the research meaningfully, keyword, involved at all stages of the research? And then independent review. Is the research going to be reviewed for scientific and ethical content by legitimate review panels? Next slide. So most of you listening are probably very familiar with the ethical concerns we've seen and will see with regard to HIV treatment and prevention research. The ethical issues in HIV cure research are not new to research or research ethics. They can certainly be different than what we're used to seeing in HIV research. But either way, whether or not they're new, they still require thoughtful management. We have all kinds of science that's progressing very rapidly, so that there's a lot of stuff to think about. Concerns about the ethics of HIV cure research, if you can see from this chart, arise from the fact that these studies enroll basically relatively healthy HIV-positive volunteers, but the studies currently offer no prospect of direct benefit and have a number of important risks, and, of course, we have effective therapy. And these are all things that we're going to discuss in the coming slides. So we can go to the next slide, and Lori, if it's okay, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Sure. So we're going to talk a little bit about what some of the current cure strategies are. We're not going to go into great detail. There have been some previous webinars that AVAC has had that I believe are available online that will go into more depth in the science. One area being explored for cure research is gene modification. And basically there are two major ways that that's conceptualized. One is genetically altering your body in some way, altering the cells in a way that will make them either resistant to HIV or making them better at fighting HIV. And the other approach is to genetically alter HIV itself to disable the virus in some way. Another strategy being pursued is what is often known as kick and kill, which is essentially using latency, what they're calling latency reversal agents. And what those do is essentially wake up the cells where the virus is hiding and stimulate that cell to, again, begin producing itself to produce, and then that will produce the virus. It will have the viruses start to produce more of itself, and it will get kicked out of the cells where it's hiding, and then it becomes available for either ARVs or your body's immune system to ultimately be able to kill it. And the other thing that are being looked at are immune modulators, and these are things that strengthen your immune system to be better able, more effectively able, contain HIV. What's ultimately likely to happen is some kind of combination strategy that may involve, say, genetically strengthening the immune system and using that perhaps in combination with a latency reversing agent. So these are some of the kinds of things that are being looked at, and there are multiple products and methods being used to implement these. Okay, next slide. So each of these carries some ethical challenge with it. Some of the ethical challenges really cut across all the methods, and some may be specific to particular methods. Next. So when we're looking at ethics, one of the things we're looking at is social benefit, as was mentioned. And another thing that we're weighing against that is, what is the individual risk to a person? And if we're thinking about ethical principles, which include beneficence, which is an avoidance of harm and respect for people, you have to, just because there's a social value to the research, it doesn't necessarily trump the level of individual risk you're asking any particular individual to take on. And with all of these strategies, at some point you would need to do some kind of so for all of these, we're hoping to have some kind of a big social benefit. So if you're living with HIV, the idea of not having to remain on treatment, not having to take medications every day, not having to endure side effects, and having long-term suspension from dealing with the medicine, and there's a potential reduction in stigma for people with HIV. You know, if you don't have to worry about somebody discovering your pills at home, if you no longer perhaps have HIV in your body, if you can no longer transmit HIV, those things can result in a reduction in stigma. And then ultimately, if enough people are cured who are not currently being reached with existing treatment, you could potentially be reducing the amount of HIV transmission, reducing the epidemic, and perhaps reduce global spending on HIV care and treatment, but that will depend a lot on what the price point of the cure ultimately is. Next. So when we think about the social value of cure research, that happens within the frame of the burdens and limitations of current HIV treatment. Having a cure will not necessarily ultimately mean the end of AIDS, we'd have to have very broad blanket coverage of the cure and widespread accessibility for that to happen. And it takes a long time to have cure diffuse for any disease diffuse globally. Looking at research on acute infection and chronic infection and how those may respond differently, and there are reasons for pursuing a cure versus improving art or prevention methods. And one of the things that ultimately we as a global society need to decide is how do we allocate the resources that are available, and how much of that do we think is worth investing in cure research versus better treatment or prevention, and where are those trade-offs? Next. So one of the key principles of ethics is respect for persons, and one of the ways that we operationalize that is through informed consent. And in order for research to be ethical, the person engaging in the research needs to be able to make a decision, a free decision, and an informed decision about whether or not they want to take on the risks associated with the research. And with very early cure trials, it's very likely that there won't be any benefit to the person that's engaging in the research. What often happens when people participate in research is they may have what's called therapeutic misconception or curative misconception. So with therapeutic misconception, you believe that you're going to have a health benefit. Even if I tell you, you have a 50-50 chance of getting a placebo versus an active agent in something, because I'm wearing a white coat and I'm a nurse or a doctor, you may just believe whatever I'm giving you is going to work, regardless of what I tell you. And sometimes that's a difficult thing to overcome. Curative misconception is the same idea, except the idea that you think that if I participate in this trial that we're calling a cure trial, you may have a high belief that you are going to be cured. And I want to take a minute and distinguish between belief and hope. If anyone's ever played the lottery, most of us know that when we buy a lottery ticket, there are many millions of people buying the lottery ticket, and our odds of winning the lottery may not really be that great. We buy it perhaps with a hope that we'll win, but not with the expectation that we'll win. But if I really expect to win, if I really believe that I'm the person who's going to believe the lottery, I'm going to win the lottery despite there being many other lottery ticket buyers, that's kind of the level of that goes beyond hope that crosses over into what we might call a therapeutic misconception level of belief. Next.
So, Laura.
Yes.
Before we move on, there's just some really nice chatter that has kind of come in on the chat, and I want to bring it up. One is this idea that the history of the plague years will also haunt future generations, and historical trauma has become evident in the millennials who did not live through those years. So I think as you're talking about some of both the misconceptions, you may not be therapeutic, right? I think this person is also saying they could – there could be that harm that has kind of come in as well.
So you're talking about a misconception about the level of harm that might be involved?
Correct.
Uh-huh. Right. And, you know, and we mentioned Nazi Germany. There has certainly been kind of an ugly history of human trials. In the U.S., many people talk about Tuskegee, where people with syphilis remained untreated, and many of the studies that were done on people in the military, exposing them to radiation, exposing them to acid with LSD without telling them. So people may have that as a framework when they're considering whether or not to participate in research and whether they believe they can trust researchers and whether or not research is ethical. So that's a bit different than therapeutic misconception, but it certainly is a factor that plays into people's decision-making processes.
Great.
So another factor that plays into the ability to consent is to really be able for researchers and community members, participants, to be able to communicate with each other in ways that they understand. So scientific literacy is helping to translate science into terms that lay people understand and make sure that they can actively participate in an informed way. It's hard to give informed consent. It's hard as a community to say, well, yes, we think we want this trial or we don't want this in our community, unless you understand research, understand the concepts of research, and understand the concepts used in discussing the study. And it's also really important for researchers and scientists to understand how communities and community members view research and what they need in order to feel trustful of the researchers, in order to want to engage in the research. So more can be done on both sides, and doing things like these webinars is a way of helping to increase both scientific and community literacy. Next. So as we've already said a couple times, early cure studies are not likely to have individual medical benefits for participants. One of the things, though, outside of curative types of benefits and medical benefits, there are other benefits that people get from participation. For many, there's a desire to help their communities, or they feel good about themselves. There's an altruistic desire to give and support other people. Some people are looking to the next generation. What would it mean to somebody personally to be part of finding the cure, and what that means for them? So there are certainly benefits that accrue to people that are separate and apart from the medical benefits that somebody might experience or not from being in a trial. Next. So language is important, and I think there's lots of room for us to, you know, as community members to decide what kind of language we would like to see used, study versus trial versus experiment. If I call somebody a curative study, if I call something a curative trial, or if I call it an experiment, do you have different thoughts about what you believe the likelihood is that particular study is going to lead you to be cured or not? Do those words make a difference, and should we be conscious of which ones we use? There's a lot of baggage that goes with the word cure, and people are defining cure differently. Some people are talking about a sterilizing cure, and I've heard some people don't really like the word sterilizing, but what people are talking about there is completely eradicating HIV from the body. And there are people talking about functional cures, where essentially you're keeping HIV from doing any damage, you're keeping it from being transmittable, you're keeping the virus from reproducing, you're keeping your immune system under control, but the virus is still there. And some people think we shouldn't use the word cure at all for that. Maybe it's more like a remission, maybe it's more durable control, long-term control. So what do we call these different things? And again, how do the words we use contribute or not to curative misconception, to influencing whether or not someone chooses to participate in a trial? what risks they're willing to assume and what they believe about that. And then the other thing is, what words are we using for describing people who participate in trials? Historically, we've referred to people as human subjects. Researchers often have to go through what's called human subjects training in order to be able to carry out research that's funded with government dollars. Some people talk about patients, typically in a clinical setting, and many people prefer to be referred to as participants, as free agents who are choosing to be in research. Next.
So, Lori, this has been great. And before we kind of move on, I just want to ask, because there are some people just on the phone, if there are any questions about the trial design piece before we kind of move into determining risk. Again, you can hit *7 to unmute your line, or you can type in the chat function.
This is Sam. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I was just going to you had posted the R side benefits enough question. I could address that very quickly now, or it can come up again later. So side benefits, sometimes we call them indirect benefits, depending on who you're talking to. So there's a lot of disagreement about the extent to which indirect benefits can be used to help us justify risks in clinical research. I think generally, and especially for me, we tend not to use indirect benefits like payment or other kinds of good things that come out of a study that are not related to the benefits of the intervention. We tend not to use those to justify risks normally if we're concerned about the risks of the study. We would want to see an intervention that we think there's a reasonable prospect of direct benefit. At least that's normally the way that I think about it. But, you know, we do, outside of clinical research, we pay people all the time to do very, very risky things, and sometimes people use that as an analogy to help us think about the extent to which things like money or other kinds of benefits can be used to justify risks. But I generally don't think about it that way. So.
Yeah, and generally, we don't think of money as a benefit. Even when we're paying people, we consider that compensation. So sometimes when we're asking people to either assume risk, or we're asking them to just assume the inconvenience of getting to the trial site, spending their time, taking an interview, what we're really doing is compensating people for what they're going through, and compensation should never be identified as a benefit, particularly when we're doing informed consent for people, that really needs to be seen as something separate. And also when we pay people, there has to be some kind of a balance so that you're avoiding what we call undue inducement, where the reward that we're offering, the compensation that we're offering, might be great enough for somebody to assume a risk they normally wouldn't undertake. So if I'm willing to pay you, you know, $5 for something, you might not be willing to put your life on the line, but if I was paying you $500,000, maybe you would. So, you know, and where that line is very, very different contextually for different groups of people, for different kinds of settings and circumstances. And where that line is, there's often disagreement about what might be undue inducement versus showing you respect for giving up your time or taking on, you know, or doing whatever it is you've agreed to do. So those things really are important distinctions. The other thing, again, is that even if there's a high social benefit to something, we can't place an undue burden on any particular individual to assume a risk that's too great in proportion to what they might otherwise experience. And again, where that line is often where the ethical debate winds up being.
Mm-hmm.
Great. And that actually raises a good point that came up in the chat, which is we need to really delve into this concern and come up with something more for participants other than benefiting or advancing scientific knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Jess, I missed the end of that. So we need to come up with
something more than just benefiting or advancing scientific knowledge.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, those are really tough questions. I mean, when you read protocols, obviously they spend a whole lot of time coming up with very substantive justifications for why they're doing the research. I mean, I think that, you know, when we're doing clinical research, it's largely supposed to be for, it is, especially if it's coming from the NIH, it's supposed to be for public health benefit, whether it's, you know, somewhere along the 1, 2, or 3 phase spectrum where it's pretty clear where we're going, or it's early phase, more exploratory things. I don't think, at least in the protocols that I review, that we're just exploring things for the sake of advancing science. I think everything has a public health or we're trying to improve people's actual healthcare kind of goal in mind, even if it doesn't always look like that.
Right. Often what, you know, you're much of research is stepwise. You can only take one little step at a time. So if your end vision is cure, if your end vision is let's find ways to keep HIV out of the body, you kind of start with the end vision and then back up. So at the very beginning, where you have to back up to is somebody has an idea that I think, well, if we do X, Y, or Z to this cell, or if we do X, Y, or Z to this virus, then we think X, Y, or Z will happen. And so step by step, you're looking at, well, does, you know, if I do X, Y, Z to the cell or the virus, did I see what I want to see? Did I see, but at what, and at what cost? Did I see that when I changed things to do this to the virus? Did I also change something else in the body that made me really, really, really sick in some other way? We've had, you know, numerous trials in and outside of HIV get stopped for all kinds of reasons when we find something that wasn't expected. Just this week, there was a trial on a schizophrenia drug that was halted because the liver side effects were way too great, and they had to stop the trial. They said, nope, this isn't safe enough. It doesn't matter. We're not going to let this keep going because now we know that this happens. But until you do the trial, you're not going to know what happens. And we're gonna go into that more specifically with some of the issues that could come up with some of the HIV strategies being explored.
Right. Yeah, trying to predict the risks is incredibly difficult, and you know, there's all kinds of literature out there on, you know, the extent to which we can rely on preclinical research, and you know, with certain kinds of information moving into studies, what are the kinds of things that we can expect, and how can we manage them? And yeah, it's really challenging.
And what do we owe people? I used to be involved in microbicide research, which is a biomedical prevention technology, and there was a lot of talk about what is the obligation to people who become HIV positive during prevention trials in terms of, you know, providing treatment, treatment post-infection. And often people want to see, well, that you'll provide lifelong treatment, but often studies are funded for 3 to 5 years, so how do you guarantee lifelong treatment to people? So
right.
Some of those kinds of challenges come up.
Yes, post-trial.
So that's actually a nice segue into the next phase of determining risk and what we know and what we don't.
Sure. So before we ever do trials in humans and I'm talking about biomedical research now, first, we do what's called preclinical research, and that involves research in the lab, things you think about using, you know, petri dishes and culturing virus and doing things like that. And after, if there's some evidence that what we're thinking will happen may be happening, then they move from the lab into doing animal studies. and then based on what gets observed in the animals in terms of toxicities, in terms of the response, then we begin moving into very, very small safety trials. And based on those, we begin to allow more people to enroll. Usually safety trials initially typically are in HIV negative people. Then you might move to people who have HIV, you move to larger groups of people, and ultimately when you believe you have enough safety data and it looks like things seem to be happening the way you think they are, then you move into these bigger phase three trials where you start to really look to say, okay, is this doing what we think it's going to do, and see whether or not the product actually works in the world. So, and when you determine the risk, you can only work with what you know, and often there are risks that you may not even know, and that's one of the things we're dealing with in cure research, is that sometimes it's not possible to know what the risk is going to be until you take it on. And there's risks to participation that go beyond the physical. There could be social risks, particularly around HIV, where there's often stigma. There could be emotional risks involved in participating in research. So people don't always think about some of the things beyond the physical. And then what is the acceptability of those risks? One of the things that, you know, again, another area of great debate is pregnant women. If we don't know much about a product, you know, most people think it's not ethical to expose a fetus to something if we don't know what the impact will be on the one hand. On the other hand, if you know that pregnant women are likely to use the product or be exposed to it after it's approved, if you don't do it in a research type setting, how are you going to ever know what the impact is? And then who gets to decide what's acceptable and what's not? You know, do I as an individual get to decide? Does the community get to decide we want this here, we don't want this here? And who is the community, right? There's no such thing as a monolithic community. Often the way we try to operationalize ethics is through different kinds of regulatory structures. There's something called an institutional review board that many places have, to where somebody other than the researcher reviews the study and makes decisions about is the risk benefit here sufficient for us to say, yes, we think it's okay for this study to happen, for you to go ahead and expose people to these risks, given what we think the potential benefits will ultimately be. Next.
So is it all right if I grab the mm-hmm. one on treatment interruption? So speaking of having trouble predicting risks, so we're going to, just as a kind of a small case study, we're going to talk very briefly about treatment interruptions in HIV cure studies. treatment interruptions have been done for a while for all kinds of reasons in HIV, but treatment interruptions in cure research are done when we have exposed people to some kind of experimental intervention and we need to test for efficacy. And there's a lot of disagreement about the extent to which the information that we're getting from treatment interruptions is stuff that we can actually use to assess efficacy, but nonetheless we are doing them and they're playing an important role in cure studies, but they have some notable risks, and as I mentioned, there's a lot of uncertainty in determining clinically, like for people's actual health outcomes, what those kinds of risks may mean. So, for example, if you're doing a study, you give people an experimental intervention, you take people off therapy so that the virus can come back, that may expand the reservoir. Okay. But we don't know what that will mean clinically over the long term for people, because in general, treatment interruptions in cure studies are very short and very closely monitored. If we're exposing people to more virus, it might make inflammation more durable, it might stick around longer. And an important risk that I believe there's some data on in cure studies is there's an increased risk of transmission, because the virus will come back, and that can be a very difficult thing to monitor and to prevent, and it raises questions about what are our obligations to people who are not in cure studies, to the partners of people that are in these partners of people that are in cure studies, and if we do have an obligation, or if it's something that we feel is very important to do, how do we go about managing that? Next slide.
And just before we on, there was a great question about what is durable inflammation, and it really just means that inflammation is around longer. So there's always inflammation, but with more activation of your immune cells and your virus, there's increased inflammation.
Right, great. what I just explained is kind of a very small piece of the concerns about the science of treatment interruption, the risks of treatment interruption. We can, to the extent that we're going to do treatment interruptions, there are a number of things that we can do in our studies, which people are already doing. There are a lot of protocols out there that are doing a great job trying to carefully manage these. So just as some examples, you can very carefully select participants that are in some way going to be less likely to be harmed by treatment interruption. So you don't want to enroll people with certain kinds of comorbidities. You might want to enroll people that have a higher CD4 so that they're healthier coming in. So when they come off treatment, it's not necessarily as damaging. You may also want to enroll people that have no history or very limited history of resistance, in case, you need to change people's regimens. You want to make sure that there are a lot of options available. As I already mentioned, you should be very carefully monitoring viral load. Different studies are doing these things differently based on the kind of study that they're doing and what we know about the risks, but you might want to monitor viral load weekly. You might want to do it more. You might want to do it a little bit less. You might want to have optional additional viral load monitoring. And then when viral load comes back to a predetermined level, and there's disagreement over what that level should be, but you want to make sure that people immediately go back on treatment. And then when it comes to the potential increased risk of transmission, you might want to regularly, like at every visit or very frequently throughout the course of the study, counsel participants on barrier protection. And you may even want to consider PrEP for partners. How to actually operationalize that, I'm not sure, but those are just things to consider to help make treatment interruptions safer, because it seems like for now we don't have the assays that are sensitive enough to detect changes in the reservoir size, at least in the ways that we need to evaluate experimental interventions. So
the hope is also with a treatment intervention that in fact the virus won't come back. Part of doing the treatment interruption is to see, well, did this work, and should something actually prove to be effective, then the virus actually won't be coming back. The problem is we don't know if and when that's going to happen. So there is definitely risk involved in these treatment interruptions.
Right. So we've only seen, obviously, one person who has been, as far as we know, cured of HIV. And we have seen a number of examples where assays have been unable to detect the fact that someone has a reservoir, and then they stay off treatment, and then the virus comes back. So, right now it's really hard to expect anything beyond, like, did we see a change in the reservoir size? Or those are for eradication studies. for control studies, did we see certain kinds of indicators that help us better understand the extent to which interventions are controlling the virus.
Right. And so with these specific interventions, people have brought up different specific concerns associated with each of those. So I'm going to touch on them a little bit. And what they do is they really play into the risk-benefit ratio and also perhaps some of the things we need to talk about in informed consents when we're asking people to voluntarily participate and make decisions about participating, so they can really assess some of that. And it's also issues that are concerned when making decisions about should we do this trial at all. So next. So there are a number of things that have been raised around genetic modification, cell and gene therapy. One of the things that comes up is scalability of the approach. Now, personally, I believe scalability is going to be an issue for every single approach that is being explored. There's some more work that may need to be done to overcome some of the issues as gene therapy exists today. But it's a rapidly advancing field, and again, I'm not sure that the scalability challenges are really that much bigger with this particular approach, but it is definitely an issue that gets raised frequently. Risk to participants who are otherwise healthy, and again, some genetic approaches, clade difference, clade just means it's a different variant of the virus, and in different parts of the world, there tend to be these different variations that are dominant, and so will the intervention actually work across all these different kinds of what they call clades of virus? And again, that may hold true for some of the other methods as well. And is there anything genetic, either racial or gender-based, that might wind up making any kind of a difference in response? And again, we see that with some of the other methods as well. Next. So kick and kill, right now we're not even sure what the size of the reservoir actually means. Does it make a difference how much difference does it make if it's reduced, and how much does it need to be reduced to? Right now we have not seen any substantial reduction in the size of the reservoir in studies done to date. One of the concerns that comes up is could you actually wind up growing the reservoir once you begin to wake it up? Some of the agents that we know that are latency reversing have been identified as carcinogens. And is that a method that we think should be continue to be explored? Are there ways to mitigate that? And again, as with all of these, the early phase research benefits may not accrue to the individual. Again, it's that social benefit versus the individual benefit, and what kind of risk can we be asking people to take on in that context? Next. The immune modulators, and so these are things that make your immune system better at fighting HIV, there's a lot of work right now. Well, there's different kinds of cells being explored. I'm not going to go into the details, but one of the concerns is could you actually develop autoimmunity? Say you wind up overproducing what your immune system needs, and then your immune system starts to attack your own body, and you wind up with some kind of an autoimmune disorder. Again, there's concerns of, you know, is it possible that you'll actually be growing the reservoir because we don't know enough about how these methods work. Also, so far, antibodies, we haven't found a way to keep them sustained for very long periods of time, and so will this be a sustainable approach? Next. So there are a lot of things we try and do to operationalize ethics. You know, ethics is, you know, the big picture questions about trade-offs in many different ways, and in how we treat people and in our ability to really answer a scientific question. So in order to operationalize making research ethical, there are a number of things that happen. So even before a trial begins, often researchers will voluntarily engage in community engagement processes. We've set up structures like institutional review boards, which are and ethics review committees. And so these are independent group of people that will review a protocol and say, yes or no, we think that you can ethically carry out this study, that the risks are worth it, and that people are being treated correctly in the study. There are various guidelines that exist that talk about what you need to do and what you cannot do if you're going to ethically carry out your research with people. Research funders often insist that you follow some of these guidelines. Some actually require that you have specific training in human participant research during the trial process, making sure that protocols and procedures are followed, making sure that there is informed consent. And informed consent, I just want to also say, is a process. It's not just a one-time event, and I believe there's going to be a separate session on that. The other thing that often happens during trials are what are called data safety and monitoring boards. And what these do are often during a study, the researchers themselves will be what's called blinded, which means they may not know who's actually getting the intervention versus, say, a comparison arm. But the Data Safety and Monitoring Board has information on what's happening, who's getting what, and they actually look during the trial to see, are we seeing a difference between these groups? Is one group clearly benefiting from the intervention more than the other group is? And if they do see that benefit earlier than expected, they may actually stop a trial early and say, we've answered the question. It's no longer ethical to carry out this research. We can really see that this product is doing what it's supposed to do and it's helping people. Or maybe we're seeing, oh, this product really didn't do what we thought it was going to do and it's hurting people. And it's hurting people at the level that it's not okay to keep this study going. Sometimes what they'll see is that the social conditions have changed and a question may have become unanswerable. So an example is one of the microbicide studies had to be stopped because the rate of new infections in the place they were doing it was much lower than they thought it would be. So they didn't think they would find enough people who became positive that they'd be able to answer the question of, is there a difference between the groups? So at that point, they said, it's no longer okay for people to take on these risks. We have to stop the study. So they can play an important role in making sure that the study is still worth doing, that the question is still what we call an equipoise, where there's a balance of not knowing, is this better or not better than not having this. So,
and as Lori said, we will be having a separate webinar on the operationalizing ethics, which includes a focus on informed consent in 2 weeks.
Yeah. So people who are interested in these issues may want to pop back on where we dive into all of this in much more detail. So I think people who want to talk about how we manage this will enjoy that. That next session.
So I guess we're just, this is the end of the presentation. So if, Jess, there are specific questions you want us to address in the next 5 minutes. I think if you go to the next slide, there are some example questions. Oh, okay. Maybe not.
Oh, they didn't get there, huh?
Okay. Oh, there they are. Okay.
So before we go on, there were 2 points that came up in the chat, and I do want to thank you both. They're not questions, but they raise an interesting point that there are two actual gene therapy considerations, one of which off-targets were not mentioned. And the second is that there actually has been a recent study using a gene editing technology called CRISPR that shows that it actually showed resistance. So there are other considerations, and I think this raises the point that both of you mentioned about not knowing what some of the risks may be when you're trying to design protocols.
That's a good point. I know one of the things that's come up with CRISPR in general is, you know, the whole idea of heritability. And I know none of the things right now that are being pursued in gene research for HIV cure or heritable, which means the idea of being able to actually make a change in your gene that can be passed on to your children. That's a big ethical issue that people are not wanting to have happen. But it is a concern, and certainly the off target is something that they test a lot for, because that is definitely a concern.
I was just going to add very quickly that maybe many of you on the phone are already familiar. I haven't listened to the meeting, but the Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee, the RAC, just had a meeting, I think, last week, where they brought a protocol up that was using CRISPR technology. And there was maybe yesterday or within the last couple of days an editorial in Nature about some of these issues. So I just recommend that people go check that out.
Yeah, and with some of these points, just within the last minute, I think just to think through that these are all issues with both trial design for researchers that they are struggling with, and also for community, both in what to participate in, but also how to participate in this process. So as I mentioned, we will be doing a regulatory piece, but since we are getting close to the top of the hour, there's just some comments about coming in about, yes, they'd love to read the Nature article, and just thanking everybody for participation. So I want to thank both Sam and Lori for giving us a really nice discussion and an outline on some of these questions. If you do have continued questions or comments, please feel free to email avac@avac.org, and we will go ahead and ask your questions to presenters and get back to you. And then also, if you have additional, if you want additional information, you can go ahead and visit the curriculum page and find out more webinars as well as resources. So thank you, everybody, so much, and have a wonderful day, afternoon, or evening.
Bye. Thanks for having us.
Bye.